Welcome to The Marketing Commute, a podcast that explores the roads taken and lessons learned for the best and brightest in marketing today. I'm Mike Boyd, and joining me on the commute this time are Andrew Baxter, Senior Advisor at KPMG Australia.
Hi, Mike.
Professor Vince Mitchell, Professor of Marketing at the University of Sydney Business School.
Hello.
As well as Carmen Becker, Partner at KPMG Australia, who leads their CMO advisory practice.
Good afternoon.
In this episode of The Marketing Commute, we sit down with John Moore. John was most recently the Director of Marketing and Global Head of Customer Lab at Bupa, one of the world's largest health insurance companies. He's back in Australia now after a few years in the UK and is with us in the studio today for what should be a very interesting chat. All right, let's go. All right, people, what's caught our eye this week?
For me, there's a whole piece coming out still, and it's been coming out for quite a while now, around consumer wearables. And, you know, anything from your Apple watches to your Galaxy watches and Fitbits. And I'll be interested to hear John's opinion later. I mean, it's capturing so much data for us. And obviously you've got anything from hospitals to doctors to insurance companies who are now really interested in what data that's capturing.
Also, according to a new market research report we've seen by BIS, global surgical robotics market was estimated at $4.71 billion US in 2018 and projected to grow to over $15.43 billion by 2029. Thought this was quite amazing, because whoever thought that you could have surgery done by a robot between one country and another country, or, you know, someone down the road, it would be quite a foreign thought to someone going in for surgery. But here we are with a market that's expanding at the rate of, and apparently 900,000 surgeries were done using surgical robotics last year out of a total of 313 million procedures. So that figure's pretty high, I think, for something that is quite new and quite different. What this means is, though, that surgeons can be anywhere in the world, and you can actually have the best from any country conduct your surgery.
So there are two implications, I think, yeah, for rural Australia. Obviously, this is potentially bringing to those people the best that the urban areas have. But also, I think it potentially opens up a market for medical export. Yeah, which I hadn't considered until you said now. Yeah, they're actually the world's best surgeons. Yeah, can be part of, rather than going to Singapore and having a medical procedure in there, then Singapore comes to you. Yeah, wherever you are, given that you've got that equipment. So there's potential export opportunities as well.
And enabled, obviously, by technology, and 5G is one of the biggest enablers of that.
Yeah, and I mean, DDB New Zealand just did a 2.5 minute ad for Vodafone, and the whole theme was a surgical vet from Japan working on some guy's dog in the backwaters of New Zealand.
What caught my eye this week, was Dentulu, which is one of these apps. It's apparently a cross between Tinder and Uber for dentists. Very high quality dental treatment. Okay. Who come to your home and create a dental experience. Not cheap, but apparently some people can't make it to the dentist. So
dentists aren't cheap anyway. So I had a 10-minute appointment that was $75 just the other day. This sounds like an amazing thing. How would it work?
I'm just curious as to how you carry around all that equipment into somebody's home. Maybe there's a limited amount of procedures that they can do. I don't know.
Plenty to chew on.
Now, as Mike mentioned at the top of the show, this week's guest was, up until recently, the Director of Marketing and the Global Head of the Customer Lab at Bupa, which is one of the world's largest insurance companies. He's just recently left that role and returned to Australia, and we're really lucky to have John here in the studio, and we look forward to chatting with him about his extraordinary journey. Thank you, John, for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, just before we get into the passion that you've had for the last 3 years around health tech, I just want to chat a bit about what was your marketing career. And you obviously didn't study marketing, you studied economics. What made you decide to sort of take a bit of a detour down the marketing road?
Honestly, the only reason why I changed path was graduate program. So as part of my first job, I did a graduate program, and for one rotation, I went out of derivatives and foreign exchange and was told I had to do something that wasn't economically based, and ended up in marketing. And I was drag kicking and screaming into it. And I absolutely loved it. And literally that was that change, which was, did it for 3 months, thought, this is kind of fun. It was the data side of marketing, and then just sort of stayed in that trajectory the rest of my life.
And then at what point did it sort of then start to take off? I mean, data back then would have been a very different to what it is today. So when did it kind of take off for you?
It wasn't really a point in particular. There was a couple of clear steps that I did stuff. So I am someone who gets bored easily and am very open to what else could I do. So at the start of that CRM space, Siebel was just coming in and so forth, and National Australia Bank at that stage were working on a big CRM project. I went to my boss and said, I'm bored. Is there anything interesting to do? And he said, why don't you go to Michigan National and implement the CRM piece or Siebel piece over there? So I did.
Right.
And spent 6 months between Michigan National and Clydesdale Bank in the UK doing that piece of work. And from that sort of built that network, which then took me back to Canada working for CIBC in one of the banks. And due to the wonders of Enron, my boss, because we were a Global Crossing and Tier 1 Enron lender, so hence paid a $2.8 billion US fine. They changed the management team around a significant amount, and that included the CMO going. And I was approached to do the role. And I actually had that conversation, which is I'd spent all my time in the analytics, database marketing, and sort of data-driven side of things. And the feedback from the CEO was, well, we can hire creative anywhere. We want people to understand data and can drive a strategy because we're a services business. And I think that's always been what's driven it. And then just taking every opportunity. So my now ex-wife moved to London and I thought, oh, well, I'll see if I can find a job in Vodafone and stuff like that. So I'm literally done three laps of the world.
Now, just on that, you have worked in many markets and you've also worked in many sectors. So a lot of marketers don't, and a lot of marketing, you know, I suppose a lot of senior people think that you should just work in that one sector, but you've worked across many sectors and across many countries. What's been your learnings throughout that? What are some of the points of difference? And maybe bring it back to Australia and what Australia can pick up on from overseas learnings.
So I've only ever worked in services because I just have no interest in not knowing who my customer is. So I've been quite deliberate in the sense that I don't want to work in FMCG or any other goods where I don't actually touch a customer, or frankly, I can't tell who the customer is. And I love that debate that FMCG has. Is it the supplier? Is it the wholesaler? Is it the person who's buying it? You don't have that in services. You have a very nice, clear outcome in that space. Because of that, people think that services are different. And the way in which you engage a customer, the way in which you get your brand trusted, the way in which actually you are open to trust varies quite significantly. Because trust me, when you're in health and you say something compared to when you're a bank, you have to do a lot less work. And strangely, if you're a postal service, you even have to do less work because you're starting with one of these really trusted brands. So the role of brand varies quite significantly, and that's quite fun actually to work through the different nuances. And that's been pretty consistent. The sectors actually have very different views. I think in terms of the job and why you do stuff is, I love customer and building experiences. And for me, that's what I wanted to do. And to achieve that challenge and to still have the brain stimulated, it meant I don't want to keep doing this in banking or insurance or in telcos or in health. And what it gave me by taking those moves is the ability to do that. And this space is awesome. Like, you can work anywhere in the world with the qualifications. You're not stuck to doing it in Australia. I think the hard thing and the real opportunity that Australia's got that doesn't take is that putting the person who's running this space as a representative on their exec team to drive the customer strategy, to drive the customer experiences, just doesn't happen to the extent it should. And we as an industry seem to put so much attention to creative. And frankly, creative is just a really good way to bring a strategy to life. If you do creative and creative only, then you do basically create multiple strategies, which might work sometimes and will bore people to tears other times, but it doesn't get that constant behavior. And if your goal is to bring more customers in and to keep them, because growth is why we exist in our roles. It's not around doing pretty stuff or winning awards. Reminder to all the agencies out there. It is important to think about growth, and growth means taking more value from your existing customers. So if you're not living and breathing the experience that that customer has, both onboarding, during, and buying other things, you won't be able to do the strategy and the delivery the way you should be. And I think what I've seen working in other markets is that every other market I've worked at is more committed to that sitting and being owned in a marketing space than probably this market.
Can I just follow up, John, on the customer experience part? You love knowing what that is. That's part of your passion. So what are the mechanisms that you do to make that happen other than sitting and watching your customers?
Observation is definitely one of the powerful things, but I actually had probably the best learning in the last 3 years, because I had a designer on my team who beautifully trained at St. Martin School of Design and then 10 years at IDEO, so globally, so rather good on the qualifications. And he gave me a really good insight into research, because everyone talks about research and you've got to measure customers and so forth. Research is a very good way to understand what's happened or the core of how you're doing. It doesn't create inspiration. It doesn't inspire you. Where human-centered design comes into play is, and how you select, you talk to becomes more important, is in inspiration. You don't want to speak to boring people when you're designing experiences or the average, because the average will tell you what they know. You want to speak to outliers who will give you ideas about what could be possible. And I think if I look across most work that's done, we don't spend a lot of time talking to outliers. We put a lot of money, whether that NPS and all those other things, which are fine metrics, into understanding the average. But we don't start with understanding the abnormal and being inspired by them. And that's, to me, been my biggest learning in my late 40s, has been really focus on those outside people and bring them into the design process. And only once you've designed something, then take it to the average.
It's interesting, because, I mean, in medical your research, you know, the case presentation is a valid form of research, and it's often the outliers and extremes of particular diseases that give the most insight.
It goes even further than that. In medtech innovation, what we're starting to see is it's such a hard environment to get into hospital groups and into government that they're starting with rare and chronic diseases, because these medical practitioners are almost forgotten. So they'll take up stuff before someone dealing with hypertension or some of the more major things. So it actually works the same way even in terms of creating pilots and innovation. But I do think we underestimate the power of sitting, watching, and observing. I challenge anyone, because if you've got a product, go and watch someone do it. Don't talk to them, just observe. Go and see how they do something. Like, we did some work on dental plans. So when you go and see a dentist, you get a whole plan of here's what you need to do. We went into their home, sitting on the fridge. Nothing's happening to it. They're not doing anything about it, but it's stored there and then eventually gets put behind a few photos and disappears. But you're not going to get that through any other way than actually going to where those people are comfortable, sitting, listening, observing.
And there's a lot of, interestingly, when you're talking about the customers that are the ones that are really on the edge or the disruptors or the ones that give you those really big ideas, how do you, when you're designing for that, how do you think about the nowadays, the personalization aspect that, you know, every single customer's journey is taken into account, and personalization, hyper-personalization at scale, all of that that's coming through at the moment. Marketers are wrestling with, and customer experts are wrestling with, how do we design amazing products and amazing experiences and make sure they fit with all the different journeys that we're trying to create? How do you do that?
So I don't think you can solve for everything. Like, we did some work with a neural AI engine in the UK around offering up products and services. We actually had to dumb it down because even though the box could actually think on its own, the regulator couldn't sign off on something it didn't know what was happening. So you've always got to be mindful of that. And that's another thing I'll say to marketers is spend time understanding the environment you're in rather than perfection around it. But that doesn't mean you can't coexist. And I think, to me, probably one of the best examples of this is the trainer market. And this is one where you don't know the customer. And I am crazy on trainers, as Andrew knows quite well. Nike in particular, with their sneakers offering, which unfortunately doesn't yet come to Australia, has a very limited range of high-end designers working on products which they then sell. They use that to collect a base. And from that, they've created creators groups and so forth where they actually help design and create things. So they built a product for the hyper-personalization. But that then feeds into a broader product set, which is somewhat personalized. And I think with everything you do, you've got to work out how do you meet your mass need? And that's not going to be 100% personalization because, frankly, we always assume customers want choice. That's not always the case. Sometimes they want to be led. Sometimes they want to be told. Sometimes they want to choose. And I think the assumption we always start with is the customer's always right. That's not always the case. Sometimes the customer wants your advice. Healthcare is a great one. They don't go in, most people don't spend their life thinking, I've got my orthopedic surgeon, my heart surgeon that I know I'm going to deal with every day. They rely on someone to steer them to the best way to go. And I think that's the other piece is understanding that choice piece behind it.
I'd like to ask you about lessons learned. If you were giving some lessons that you've learned to help somebody else to drive their marketing career forward, what would they be?
Your best friend is your CFO. If you don't understand where the money comes from, you'll be the crayon department. So take the time. The other thing is finance people love it if you'll spend time with them. So number one, whenever you start the company, find out someone in finance, sit down with them, say, help me through the numbers, and ask as many dumb questions as you like, and they'll be so excited that you've done that, and do that every month. And if you don't bother doing marketing because you will be irrelevant. The second piece is make sure you understand risk and compliance. If you're operating in a regulated environment, don't bother doing things that you can't do. Third, work out what I call your friends and family within an organization and involve them early. A great one is legal. If you go to legal with a campaign, they have no choice but pretty much to say no. If you involve them at start with, here's the objectives, here's what they want, they will work with you and make it possible. So, and it's the same with procurement. Like I hear all this stuff about procurement taking over marketing. Andrew knows me well enough to know that I've never had an issue with procurement because I've involved them. I don't treat them like people who are going to make my life hell. And I'd say that's the same with everything. So that's my number one move. Number two, take the time to really understand your product. Become a customer, which I know sounds really simple, but often doesn't happen. So become a customer, but don't become a customer by saying, I want access to the executive helpline or whatever. Go into a store or call someone up or do it online and actually do it yourself. Also, become customers of your competitors because you need to understand what they're doing and what they're doing well because they will be doing stuff well. And number three, be immensely curious. Your sector or your space or your world is not where the future will come from. It will come from other parts. So read, understand, and build that network. And I think my only other final piece is people talk a lot about mentors. The best advice I ever got was build your board of directors. Don't just build a mentor. And have your board of directors, which is a group of people that you turn to depending on where you're at and what you're looking for. Because it won't be one person. It will be a series of people that will help you shape what you want to do. So the same way a company does, you treat it the same. What are my board of directors who can help me and support me, both in terms of introductions, in terms of ideas, in terms of direction, and so forth, as I go through my life?
We had a good discussion earlier about marketers and customer executives at the C-suite level. What's your opinion on whether they should be sitting there, shouldn't be sitting there?
They should be sitting there. But I think, you know, there's lots of conversations. Is the next CMO going to be the next CTO or the next CDO or whatever? Titles are irrelevant. They really are. They make everyone feel really cool and important, but they don't actually add any value. The thing is, if you're playing that role, you need to be at the exec table, but you need to be deserve to be at an exec table. The key about being an exec table is not to add value about what you do for your day job. That's what you're paid to do. It's how can you bring that knowledge and influence the other people around that table in doing their job? So you as a marketer, if you're at that level, have to be broad enough to be able to have input into technology, into HR. Because let's be honest, an employee value proposition is the same as a customer value proposition. So how do you connect across? And I think that's probably the biggest thing that we miss out on too often is we don't see ourselves as being broader than marketing. Because then if you're only doing marketing, then frankly, as an exec team, marketing's covered. I don't need to worry about that. So you don't deserve to be there.
Brand is a real connection point there, isn't it? Owning that brand, the employee brand, the external brand, the internal brand. It's quite an interesting way for marketers to get that seat and to expand on it.
Look, the brand is really important and I think people underestimate it. So if you take Bupa, we're 75,000 people. That's 75,000 direct customers or should be direct customers. Then if you look at their family and so forth, you're getting up to massive numbers. It's also the best place to test ideas with. So the value proposition for a company has to encompass both customer and employee. And I think there's some great work that Airbnb did around that and how they put their head of brand is also their head of people and their head of environment. And I do think that's the other piece that's underestimated is the working environment has such a massive impact on how you bring yourself to work and therefore how you bring everything else to the business.
It's interesting you say that about using those your internal customers as a surrogate for external customers, because in people-focused business, of course, when people are spending their lives, working lives with customers, they actually have hundreds of years of experience of customers, which you can tap into when testing new ideas. So it's an interesting idea of testing external customer new products with internal employees.
It's not just the knowledge. It's also what you can do. So when you're first testing a product, particularly in a regulated market, you need to go through all the approvals and stuff or hand out very long listed forms with sign-offs and whatever. When you're doing it with your staff, you can afford to screw up because you can actually say, you can go to them and say, here's what we're doing, here's the risk. So we did some work around some AI work in dental. We just did it initially with our staff because we could have the conversation with them and say, look, this is what we're doing, here's why we're doing it, blah, 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 and it may work. So it's almost pre-beta. You can do stuff. And I'm surprised how few companies actually use their staff as their pre-beta testing space. And staff love it. Like it's great for your own internal morale as well because they feel like they're being involved rather than just receive.
Sure.
And I guess with health services, that safe to fail philosophy is very different. You can't really go into market and develop whilst in market. You need to be sure about what you're providing when it's got to do with people's health and well-being.
Fail fast and health do not go together. Yeah.
So do you think marketing as a practice is heading in the right direction? Like what's the road ahead look like from where you sit?
I would say that, and look, I've only been back in Australia for a month and a half and I'm only going by what I'm reading in text messages I get and other stuff that I see in the media. I'm actually a little bit worried about marketing in this country because it seems to be less around customer strategy and more around what I call old school marketing, which is just generating advertising and getting it out there and hopefully driving growth. I don't see the progress that I've seen sitting in other markets. And I think that's always the danger. It's the third time I've come back to Australia, and every time I come back, I make the same comment. And I think Andrew's been a receipt of it a number of times, which is whether I'm sitting in Canada, the US, or the UK, strategy leads, creative follows. Mm. When I'm sitting in this market, creative still seems to be king. When I say creative, it's not just creative from what you see on a TVC. It's how your media, what it looks like, where you're buying, how you're bringing your stories together, where does content come into play, where does experience come into play, and all those things. And I'm just not seeing, I don't see that having the same foothold that it does in the other markets I've worked in. And sadly, it hasn't grown.
My favourite quote about the future is that, you know, the future's here, it's just unevenly distributed. Yeah. So given that you have seen the future in other markets, what do you see the future of marketing as it plays out at the forefront of the future?
I think there will be a real mix between design and marketing. And I think design is one of those underrated pieces. So if you take an average CEO today, their biggest advisor is a management consultant of some kind, normally who they turn to for external advice. They all have them. I think, and Steve Jobs sort of started with John Ivey, I think a designer going forward will actually be the person who will become that advisor to a CEO and so forth. Because looking at design in its purest sense actually brings a completely different lens to it. The CEOs come with great knowledge around how corporations work, how numbers work, and all that sort of stuff. What they don't necessarily have is how do you actually design experiences? And design doesn't mean just building things. It could be building AI code through to, you know, designing a medical experience or your robots or whatever you wanted to go to. So for me, I think you're going to see this morphing of marketing from being a role driven around getting campaigns out to a role driving the design and the experiences that will come out going forward.
Now, John, you've had an amazing career in marketing, but really you did make that change about 3 years ago when you went into the health tech space. So what's the future look like for you?
The future for me is sort of still being defined, to be honest. But my passion is all around I saw some amazing health tech startups out there, and I had the privilege both sitting on a couple of VC boards and seeing a lot just through my job across Europe and the US and Asia. But I've seen very few of them actually get in and impact the health experience. And that's because unlike a typical startup space where you get a consumer to buy it, in healthcare, you actually have to get someone to pay for it, someone to provide it, a hospital group, and a doctor to use it. And all three of those people have to come in a symbiotic relationship to make it happen. So for me, I'm working with a couple of different spaces to try and get something like that up and running to facilitate these startups actually getting into a healthcare system.
Any comments on wearables and the digitized self and self-monitoring in terms of health, robotics, or the dental app?
On the wearables front, you've seen a lot of progress and movement in that space. When it's targeted at a consumer level, the quality of the information those wearables produce is somewhat dodgy. So I wouldn't be too excited by anything unless it actually came with FDA or some kind of medical accreditation, which there's not a lot. The second thing is that knowing about yourself doesn't mean you change your behavior. And there's been very little work done on how do I change habits. So for example, I know that muffin I eat this morning is not going to meet my actual energy needs, is going to add more calories than I can probably run off, but tastes really nice. So it's not something I should do, but I still do it. And it's how you change those habits, which is quite interesting, and there's work going on, but no one's really made a lot of progress. I think where the wearable stuff is getting really interesting now is the medical grade stuff, which is supporting doctors. So how do you have wearables that actually can measure at medical grade levels, which will allow for people to be monitored when they leave hospital, before they leave hospital, and so forth. So even if you take an aged care home, if you have someone going into a home, you have to make a medical assessment of them. Now, they've most likely got dementia, so having that conversation is quite difficult. Imagine you can put a wearable on them 5 days before, and then you'd have a whole heap of data that you could actually put into play. So I think where you're going to see wearables really starting to tick up is less around the consumer, which is nice and fun, but really doesn't do much medically, except for those who would already be predispositioned to looking after themselves, to actually how do we help the medical profession do things.
John, thank you. On behalf of all of us at the Marketing Commute, it's been a fantastic session with you today. And as we've all said, we could have gone on for a fortnight. And we look forward to hearing more about what you do with your next phase of your career.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So for the Marketing Minute, I've taken something from the Journal of Marketing, which is the preeminent marketing journal in the marketing field. And what it talks about is how to make your market research deliver more value. So 75% of the senior executives believe that customer insight is critical to firm performance, yet only 30% integrate market intelligence into their core decisions. The question is why? Why is that? So the research found that organizations often understand why market intelligence is important, but struggle with how it's generated, shared, and responded to across the organization. It found professionals use five dissemination practices, or mental models, if you like, of how market research is used. These are the manager as the distribution of intelligence. Secondly, as an aggregator or expert who centralizes intelligence resources, or as a salesperson who engages in consultative selling of market research, or as an educator via social learning, yet through empathy, using ethnographic storytelling to transport users into the contextual lives of consumers. And finally, as a facilitator of experiential learning, where employees participated in immersive experience with suppliers and customers. These five practices, are not mutually exclusive, because the survey found, that all participants mentioned using more than one. So one conclusion they come to is that in addition to being experts on market intelligence gathering, market research directors must also understand how organizations learn about market research and establish ways to create a shared meaning about the market that enables the disseminated intelligence to be understood and more effectively used within organizations. If firms don't have that shared understanding of the market, then staff can draw only upon their own sense of what the market research does, and that often means that any information collected by the organization isn't actually effectively used. So, gentlemen, what market dissemination practices have you seen working?
I think the one that brings things to life really strongly is the ethnography type research. It's much easier when, if you can't be there, bringing it to life, seeing a video, hearing someone talk about it, as opposed to just reading something on a bit of paper and someone's interpretation of what that was, I think is a very powerful thing.
It always comes back to storytelling, doesn't it? It's always the most effective way.
I think the challenge with some of this too is around the amount of data that's now available. And in a sense, this paper talks probably more around, classic qual research techniques. But we can access so much insight into our customers nowadays via the data, and I think that's one of the things that everyone's struggling to understand as to how that all comes together, almost algorithmically.
Yeah. What I like about this article is that it puts a lot of onus on the marketing research director, which is what I don't like. But the question it raises is, so how does the organization learn about its market? And who's responsible for that? The market research director is clearly responsible for generating that. They're not necessarily responsible for actioning all of that or disseminating it through each department within the organization. So that seems like a board level decision that this speaks to. And understanding how that organization learns about and actions its connection with the market is something separate from generating market research in the first place, and that seems to be the missing gap that sometimes means that market research, which is expected to collect, doesn't get fully utilized.
That's it for this leg of the journey on the marketing commute. Thanks to our guests, John Moore, Professor Vince Mitchell from Sydney University, to Carmen and Andrew from KPMG, our brilliant producer, Boyd Britton, the studios here at the University of Sydney Business School, and finally to KPMG's customer brand and marketing advisory team. You can find the Marketing Commute on all good podcast networks, such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and Swoot. And you can find more about our guests and presenters at themarketingcommute.com. I'm Mike Boyd. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the next stop on the Marketing Commute.
You have reached your destination.